Tier Bank Studios. Next Tier Bank, your hometown community bank. Your news time is just about 12:30. Dave Malarkey's up next with It's Your Turn. Thanks for joining us and have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, hello there. Good afternoon. Nice to have you with us on the Friday. Friday, at last, edition of It's Your Turn. We're looking forward to our conversation today with our first guest. He's here in the studio with us right now, Chris Slovic. Chris is a graduate of Knock High School, and he most recently has been working as an educator, a counselor, at a school in, ready for this, China. But he's back now here in Western Pennsylvania. And Chris, first of all, it's nice to meet you, and I've got 1,000 questions, so I'm glad you're here in the studio with us.
Thank you very much. I'm also a talker, too, so I can answer those 1,000 questions, so no problem there.
Well, of course, the first thing I want to ask about teaching internationally and so on and so forth, but you know, I'm sure the first thing that our listeners want me to ask you is about the coronavirus.
Yeah.
Because you were in China up until, what, about a month ago or something like that?
I was in China until the 20th of January. And I didn't leave China specifically at that time because it was Chinese New Year. Because they have a different New Year than our New Year. Their New Year runs for 2 weeks and it started on the 17th of January. So a lot of teachers, a lot of people in China, what they do is they wait till that New Year. The New Year that we celebrate is known as the International New Year, January 1st. So I got out of there the 20th to go on vacation. I was in Bangkok, and then it just slowly built up from there.
So while you were in Thailand, then you started to hear more reports about the coronavirus, and you didn't even go back to China.
Didn't even go back to China. I have still my vacation clothes and everything inside the luggage and all that. But that's the one thing. I was talking to other people in China, and we were talking about whether to stay there, whether to leave. And I think it was a very important point because people here might have to do it, is whenever they say separate out the information and don't believe a lot of the hype or the hysteria, that doesn't mean don't believe the bad news. I think a lot of people say they hear bad news and it's fact-based, and they go, oh, well, I don't believe the hype and hysteria, because you got to play the long game. And that's why I did, because I thought to myself, oh, it's going to get bad. It's going to get real bad there. It's going to be a unique situation. It's better to stay out of there. So that's why, you know, I talked to a few other people. Couple stayed. A few are in surrounding countries, because you can do that quite cheaply, actually. If you don't care where you're at, if you're not on vacation, you can stay in Thailand cheaply. My one buddy's with his wife's parents in Taiwan, and we just started from there.
So you're still working with the school, though. You're doing this online, back and forth between here and China?
Yeah. It's online learning. It kind of seems like everybody, I know that feeling, because you get those, you see those cyber school teachers, and you're like, oh, that's great. You don't have to worry about this or this. You could just work from home. And No. That's good for a week. What happened is, once we started in a routine, the first week is a little bit of a shift, kind of like, oh, okay, well, it's online, we can just control things. But then the second week, it starts to hit you that it's not a great ideal situation. And it kind of goes against everything why you're a teacher. You're a teacher, you like kids, you like dealing with kids and in a moment being there. But all of a sudden you don't have that online. So now it's like the second and the third week, it gets tough because now everything you know as a teacher shifts and changes. So it's like starting a new job. So then compound that with the hours. The hours now, because it's on Beijing time, it's 13 hours. So without daylight savings time, it's an exact AM and PM switch. So right now it's 13 hours. So come March 8th, it'll be 12 hours. So after March 8th, all you do is flip the AM into PM, and that's what time it is in Beijing. So you can imagine night is day and day is night. You have to do everything opposite. So I work from 7 at night to 3:30 in the morning. And it's also that culture working at night. And I know your viewers, a lot of them work shift work and stuff. And they will agree 100% that when you work night shift, nobody else knows what it's like. They bother you during the day. Like, mm-hmm. It's like, hey, do this, do that. Run out to the store at 2 in the afternoon. You're like, I'm just getting up or still sleeping.
It would be like someone with a normal schedule, you know, calling them at 2:30 in the morning and saying, hey, can you run me an errand? It's the middle of the night.
Yeah.
No, I can't.
Exactly.
Well, listen, I want to talk to you a little bit about your work in China, and you're continuing to be, you're actually a counselor at this school. But I want to review a little bit of your other international teaching work before we get into too much detail about China. I'm glad you're back here in Western Pennsylvania safe and sound.
Well, thank you.
For the time being. And we'll see what develops with the coronavirus over there. But you, first of all, you're a graduate of Nock High School.
Yes.
And where'd you go to college? Pitt, right?
I went a couple different places. I went University of Pittsburgh, and I graduated from there. I went from 1999 through 2003. I was I graduated with communications, rhetoric, and English writing on a journalism track. Did an internship at KDK. It was fun, but it was hard work. But that internship was good because it told me that TV's not for me. So then I was kind of like, okay, I'm in all these businesses where, you know, the newspapers were shutting down. What do I do next? So I went to Slippery Rock, and I got my teaching certification from there. It's a good school. It's a really good school. And we're so lucky, actually, to have it so close that we can commute to it.
I agree.
And so a very good school. And then I was trying to get jobs, and that's when the furloughs happened in about 2008, 2009. What used to be, you go to Virginia, they had jobs. They were just like trying to give jobs away. And then in about 2008, 2009, it shifted. And now all of a sudden, those jobs, like people being furloughed, are like, no, we need those jobs. So all of a sudden, they went there, and the people in Virginia stayed for a longer time because there were no jobs to come back to.
So you had to start looking overseas to teach them.
Well, what I did was, if to go overseas, they need a little domestic. So I went to Arizona for 2 years, a small copper mining town, Miami, Arizona. It's not the Miami with the beach. It's the Miami you got sand, but no ocean. But you got sand. Lots of sand and scorpions. I got hit with a scorpion one time. That's not very fun. But I went there, so I couldn't do that in English teaching. I was looking, and I thought to myself, I said, hey, what do I really want to do? And I searched around a couple things. I said, hey, I like school counseling. I like that. When I was subbing for a long time, I'm like, I love interacting with people. And I know there's a lot more, but I like the mix of it. So I got in Slippery Rock again and got my master's there. It's a great counseling school. It is. If you want to be a school counselor, there's a lot of great faculty up there. It's pretty good. It's pretty solid. So I went up there, got my master's in counseling, went out to Arizona, because that's my philosophy and things, is if you want it bad enough, it's there. You just have to do things that others won't. So going to Arizona, just packing up everything I know and driving out there 27 hours to a small house with scorpions all in it, it was needed. I had to do it. And so I started out there, and then I went internationally after that.
And where did you first teach internationally?
It was a small town. Small town. I say small town. It was about 100,000 people. It was twice as big as Butler. But it was in Yanbu, Saudi Arabia. So it was 3 hours north of their biggest city in Saudi Arabia. Isn't Riyadh. It's actually Jeddah. Jeddah is Arabic for grandmother, I believe. I might be wrong. I know it's a call-in show, so if I'm wrong, somebody call in and tell me. But so it's 3 hours north, And it's a lot of oil, natural gas. So a lot of the people there, we had like 27 different nationalities and a lot of different kids. It was about 600 kids, K through 12. And it was the best, and I'm going to say this, it was the best school community I've ever been in my life. And that's not to degrade anything else. It was that much above anything else. There are some great school communities I've been in where I'm currently now and where I've subbed around here, you know, great school communities. But that one was just even higher and above because everybody was transient. They all knew everybody's struggles of coming in, especially to a society like Saudi Arabia, how everything was different and stuff, and everybody had to adapt.
So were the kids that were in the school that you were where you were teaching in Saudi Arabia, were they children of American families who were over there, businessmen or workers, or were there other nationalities besides American kids in this school?
Yeah, there was a total of 27 nationalities. So we had Americans, we had a few Filipinos, we had a couple Venezuelans, we had a few Indians, Pakistanis, and then we had like a few from countries that were like one-off oil countries, like Nigeria. We had a couple Nigerians from there because they needed people in the country to run the oil stuff and all that. Nigeria is a huge oil country, and Lagos has a lot of that stuff. So we had a few Nigerians in there. We had a few Egyptians in there, and we had Jordanians and all that. So we had all around. And we did have Americans in there, too, but it was proportionate. So I would say we had maybe 10, 15% Americans.
And you were a counselor.
School counselor, yeah.
Were you counseling them as to career choice, career guidance, as we would think of as a guidance counselor here in the U.S.?
Yeah, it was. That was in Saudi Arabia I did that. And still to a point here in China in Beijing. But I did that. It was interesting because all the people from different nationalities, they had kind of the same goals of what they wanted to do, but it was different on how they would achieve it. And also, as an international school counselor, the layer above that was visas. There were some kids that I had to actually look into on, can you go to this country? Can you come to the United States? Because there were restrictions. And then my second year, I started really getting into it, like researching what they ask for visa questions. Because any visa process is a very cold process. It's cold. And I know that there's a lot of warmth in people here. You go to the DMV. I can't say warmth in DMV. But I would say it's harsher than DMV. I mean, you'll go up to a window and your number, and they'll start asking you questions and probing. Are you going to just stay in the United States and overstay your visa? But they don't say that. They do it indirectly. And if they don't like you, they just shut the window. And you get to know, so I had to help prep them for that.
Some of our listeners might not be familiar with the visa requirements. Here in the U.S. for American citizens, if you want to visit most foreign countries, all you need is a passport. There are some countries, however, where you will need a visa from that country before you can get in.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing for citizens of other countries who want to come to the U.S.
Yeah.
If you're from Great Britain, no trouble. You got a passport. You can fly in. Certain other countries, you need a visa. So that can be a complicated process. Most of the kids that you were counseling wanted to come to the U.S. to go to college. Was that the deal?
What was different? And I had to learn a lot of different systems. So we had – the U.S. has a lot of opportunity in it. I think around the world – the United States university system is different than other university systems, and it's really a likable system because in the United States, when you go to a university, when you're in, you don't have to do anything else. When you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So if I go to Penn State or if I go to Pitt, why did I say my arch rival first, or if I go to Slippery Rock, if I'm in, I can say, I want to change my major because they get you because of your character. They get you because your work habits, your work ethic, and all that stuff. If you go to most other countries, if I go to maybe a country in Europe or something like that, and I say, okay, I want to apply. What do you want to do? And we go, engineer. Well, let's say you start engineer and you say, okay, I don't want to do that. I want to be a writer, or I want to be something else. I'm going to be a doctor or a lawyer. You have to reapply to that college, and you don't necessarily will be accepted. So if there's an engineering college that accepts everybody, and there's a doctor, like a medical field, that doesn't accept many people, and you go, oh, I want to switch, you have to reapply. You might not get in, and then you're stuck without a university. So that can be a very sort of trying thing.
Interesting. We need to take a break. We're talking with Chris Slovic. And he's got a lot of stories to tell. I hope we can squeeze them all in here while he visits with us. So we'll take a break and be back with more of the Friday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR right after these words.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Welcome. We're chatting with Chris Slovic here on the It's Your Turn program for Friday. It's great to have you with us. It's nice to have Chris with us, too, because up until several weeks ago, he was in Thailand, and prior to that in China, where he works as a guidance counselor at an international school in Beijing, right?
Beijing, yeah.
The school was. And he actually, when the Chinese New Year came, he decided to go on vacation to Thailand, and while he was there, the coronavirus outbreak exploded, and he decided it would be a good idea not to go back to China right now, but to come directly to the U.S., which maybe wasn't all that easy anyway for coming from Thailand. How many flights does it take to get from Bangkok to Pittsburgh International?
Well, it's if you do it on a normal day, if you do it regularly, usually you go Bangkok to Beijing, Beijing to Detroit, Detroit to Pittsburgh. So your big thing, it's kind of cut up 5 hours, 12 hours, 1 hour.
But you didn't want to go back to Beijing.
You can't go back to Beijing because once you're in, you don't know. At that point, we didn't know if you go in, were we going to get out?
Sure.
You know, because a lot of times when you fly, one of the things about flying is you lose 2 cups of water for every hour you're in the air. So when you go in the air 5-6 hours and you lose 12 cups of water and you're dehydrated, how do I know I get to that airport and I don't have a slight temperature? How do I know I don't have something that they see?
They're going to quarantine you.
Yeah. And then you go to a place where other people with the disease have it. That's not good.
So where did you fly to?
So I had to divert, and I went a long flight to Osaka in Japan. Not the greatest of circumstances there. We were talking about that earlier. But then I had to go from Japan to Los Angeles. And it's actually a little bit longer from Japan to Los Angeles because we flew over the Pacific Ocean. And people don't realize when you fly from Detroit to Beijing, we don't fly over the Pacific Ocean. We fly over the North Pole.
North Pole, yeah.
And it's really neat. You get to see Northern Lights. You get to see, and you look down, you get to see how vast Siberia is. Siberia is unbelievable because we say here, places like in Arizona, you can drive for an hour and not see a house. There, you can fly for 3 hours and see absolutely nothing. And in the actually, in the summer, it's beautiful because it's all green. So, but I had to take the longer flight to Los Angeles, and then I flew from Los Angeles back to Pittsburgh on a budget airline, because that's the only thing that was flying then. And it's like, oh, here's like $20 for a ticket, but it's $100 for the bag. And I'm like, what? And I have my vacation stuff for 2 weeks.
Hey, you know? But you were out of China, which is the most important thing right now.
That was the biggest thing right then and there. To get home, to get – I think my thought process was I want to go to a place, number one, where there's going to be time. Because in something like this, you want time. Time's on your edge. If you're the first to get something – nobody's going to have any sort of help for you. Mm-hmm. But once people learn about it, once people have tips and things to do and ways to stay safe, they find out what works and what don't work. When you're later on getting something, you have all that knowledge that the time helped. So I was thinking time is number one. And number two, I needed a place where I could do routines. And number three, if we do go into some sort of quasi-quarantine or something to that effect, it's a place where I spoke the language and I knew the area. And I think that's really, really big, because if I'm in a place where I don't speak the language and I don't know the area, then I'm last in line for everything. Anything like a hospital, anything like food or whatever, I would be last in line. So those three things helped me make my decision. So then I came home. That's why I chose Butler. And it's a good area. It's good people. And that's one thing I want to see again.
Let me ask about language. When you were teaching in Saudi Arabia, for example, the students, I assume, were at least proficient enough in English that you could talk to them
in
English?
Oh, they were. Saudi Arabia, my one good friend, Nat Erickson, he's right now at Bali Island School. He said this quote to me, and it was one of the best. He has been international teaching and living his whole life. He's a 6'5 guy from Minnesota, beard, he has blonde hair, all that stuff. But he was born in Nepal because his parents were missionaries, and he speaks perfect Nepalese. So he's been all around the world. This is his fifth or sixth international school in Bali. So he told me this quote about Saudi. He goes, I've never been in a place where I don't need to know the local language as much as Yanbu. Everything was English. I could function. I could go to any taxi driver or something, and they knew just enough that we could get around, and there would be no sort of difference. Now, I couldn't speak like I'm speaking to you, because the English language has so many things in it that are what we call colloquialisms, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's why somebody from California and Pittsburgh sound differently. That's why we say they speak another language in England, even though it's the same language, it's different. So when it came to Saudi Arabia, the language was, I never really had to encounter a language difference. Totally different in China. You'd think capital city, you'd think international, you'd think like that. But I compare it to New York and Washington, D.C. Beijing is like Washington, D.C. It's really a bunch of people from that country. And then you have some embassies and you have a couple Western. But Shanghai is like the New York, the cosmopolitan, where everybody comes in.
I see the difference, yeah.
So with Beijing, it's all, I went in there and I'm like, oh, a little bit arrogant. You know, as I'm rolling my own eyes at myself. But I'm like, oh, they'll know just enough that I can get. I get to the airport and it's like, hi, where's the exit? And they're like, I don't understand you. And then it's pretty interesting because nowadays I still catch myself in China. What happens is Didi is the taxi. It's an app on your phone. I have it on my phone. And all you do is push buttons. Okay, that part's easy. But I go in. And a taxi driver will say something to me in Chinese, and then I'll say, I don't speak English. And he'll just say, repeat what he does louder in Chinese. But I do the same thing. I repeat louder what I say in English. I don't speak Chinese. How's he supposed to understand that? So it's a real big barrier in China.
I'm just guessing that it would be extremely difficult to even pick up a few words in Mandarin.
It is, because it's a tonal language. A lot of Asian languages are tonal. What that means is in English, it's different, because in English, we can say words like we can say Pittsburgh or Pittsburgh, and we all know that that's a city, even though the tone is different or whatever. Our phone rings, like this morning, and there was a call from Allentown, and it said Allentown or something like that. Weird, because it's one of those phones that speak and mess up all the things, Gatanning's, Kittening or whatever. But in China, if you go, hey, where I need a train to Tianjin. They'll look at you like, where's Tianjin? But you have to say like Tianjin, like that little inflection. Even now I'm saying it wrong. But that inflection makes all the difference because the language is set up.
It just seems so, I mean, I don't speak a lot of languages. I can do a little bit of German, a little bit of Irish Gaelic, English. But there are other languages where I can pick up a little bit. If I hear someone speaking French or Spanish, for example, I'm not totally lost.
Yeah.
But man, with the Mandarin Chinese or Japanese, I just have no idea. No idea what they're saying.
It's also, and here's the funny part about China. When you see other countries, everybody tries sometimes to unify it, like everybody's one. But in China, there's 5 autonomous regions. And if you look at Chinese money, which I have a little bit at home, I should have brought some, there's 5 different languages on
the
100
money.
RMB. Yeah, 5 different languages. There's. Huh. I don't know all 5 languages. I know Arabic is on one, so they do have Arabic on Chinese money. They have Pinyin. Now, Pinyin, everybody wonders, China has about 10,000 different characters in their language. So everybody's saying, well, how do they use a computer? How do they, you know, type in things? How do they? Well, what they do over there is the language is different because they use Pinyin. They're English letters, and I believe it was somebody from Yale that developed it in the 50s or the 60s or something like that. And what happens is they take all the sounds and they do it into English letters, and that's called Pinyin. So therefore, so in China, some our kids are actually trilingual because you need to know Chinese, which is writing the characters, but Pinyin also, which is like putting Chinese into English letters, and then they need to know English, so they're trilingual. So that's a whole different language in itself.
Making my head spin, yeah. Chris. Making my head spin. By the way, folks, if you're joining us a little bit late, we're chatting with Chris Slovic. Hey, if you have any questions or anything for Chris, you're always free to join us. Phone number is 283-2525, 283-2525, and we'll try to get to you as quickly as we can if you have questions or comments. How were you treated as an American in China?
I think it's a big city, so it's Beijing. And there's two different I'm still trying to figure out what's big city culture and what's Chinese culture and what's even Beijing culture in itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because different parts of China is about as big as the United States. And it's different culturally as the United States as well. So it's like somebody from Georgia and somebody from New York City. You can't go into New York City and say, oh, all Americans act like this. And then you go to Georgia and you're treated differently. You go to Tennessee or you go to Pittsburgh or whatever.
Exactly.
So it's as an American, really, I've had no problems really as an American. But I'm in a big city. So the hustle and bustle of a big city, people have to go to jobs. Now, I will say this. When you go to Beijing, there are times when I've been to the amusement park. And, yes, there were bolts missing from some of the things that I've ridden there. So, yes, that is true. But anyway, sorry about that. The biggest change as an American is, and it's kind of a cultural change, so I'm going to sound nice when I say this. There's less political correctness. And there's a lot of intrigue. So during, if you go certain places, yes, you'll get stares because you're different. And you're in areas sometimes where they don't see different people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been on subways where there's a couple hundred people and we're all slammed in there like sardines. And I'm the only guy that looks like me on the subway. And, you know, now that, when you do that, kind of, okay. But they take pictures of you.
Did you ever feel threatened? It might not be the right word. Did you ever feel uncomfortable? For example, in a situation like that, when you're on a subway and all around you, you know, you're hearing Mandarin and you don't speak any of that and you don't look like any other people. You know, did you ever feel a little bit intimidated or even dangerous sometimes?
I think you asked two good questions in that one question. I think there's a difference between threatened and uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Threatened? No, not threatened. Beijing is very safe. I've been taking DDs at 1, 2 in the morning. I've been across the city. I go to Chinese basketball games. There are NBA over there. which sometimes leave me coming home at 1, 2 in the morning. Never been threatened. I've never had... I mean, are there scams there? Yeah, there's scams. So you can't just, like, give your money out and be too trusting. But for the most part, it's extremely safe over there. I have no qualms, no worries about anything like that. Uncomfortable, yeah, because we don't realize how many systems we have over here. You know, just going to the grocery store and buying something, it can be the first time uncomfortable. When you're in a situation and you need to tell somebody, it's uncomfortable. There are certain situations I've been in where just like – and here's one of the ones that I've seen. I was over and I saw a motorcycle accident. And I don't know why. I don't want to go into the culture of it because there are people out there that could probably tell you why. But what I noticed is when I see accidents and stuff, people will circle around – but they'll wait for the guards to come. And the uncomfortableness comes of, what if I'm that person? I don't ride a motorcycle, but what if I'm in a car wreck? What if I'm in something like that and I don't speak the language and there's no way to communicate? I think people are helpful enough over there, absolutely helpful enough, that they'll say, hey, something's at least wrong. We need to go like get somebody. But then also there are some cultures which if you alert authority, then you assume a responsibility. So, again, I don't know. I'm still trying after 2 years. It's a very complex society. It's like the United States. It's very complex. People are different everywhere. So it's trying – even after 2 years, there's no one – there's no easy answers. I guess that's the philosophy of my sort of answer I'm giving you is there's – no easy answer. That in itself brings some uncomfortableness.
Do you anticipate going back to your school in China, or have you considered the possibility that you might never go back?
I'll go back because that's, you know, they're going to – I'll answer that too in two different ways. If this goes if this has a beginning, middle, and end to it.
We're talking about the coronavirus.
The virus, yeah. If this has a beginning, middle, and end to it, there'll be a date which the school says, hey, come back. And there'll be ways like 2 or 3 weeks. They'll say, okay, come back and then quarantine if there's a quarantine or whatever. So I fully intend doing that, going back. Because in the back of my head, there are all those kids there that still need a counselor. They still need somebody. And to me, I need to do that, you know, for the kids' sake. Because it's going to be more than ever when they come back. They're going to need a school counselor. They're going to need somebody to help, you know, with the mental health there. Now, if I'm projecting out about the virus, I can say I don't know. If you're asking, will I go back because certain things? One of the things is the economics. And in a school like I'm in, there are two types of international schools. There's profit and not-for-profit. Not-for-profit is like embassy schools, like, okay, like ISB, Bangkok. ISB Bangkok, ISB Beijing.
This would be for children of embassy personnel?
Embassy kids. ISOY, which is a job in Islamabad that I'm hoping to get. So if, you know, Rose Puffer, the head of the school, she's listening, please. You know, I interviewed there this year, but, you know, they had to hire, you know, other people. I didn't make it, but I'm still trying. But those kind of schools, they're funded by the United States government, so they don't have really a profit motive per se. And they're really good schools, usually very good schools. I can't speak for all of them, but the schools I know are very good schools. But I'm in a – right now, it might be a not-for-profit, might be a profit. I don't know. But we have the charter of a Chinese private school. Even though we're trying to get international people in there, we have the charter of Chinese private. So what that means is parents have to pay, and they pay big money. It costs more to go to Daystar Academy than to Penn State out of state.
That's the name of the school where they teach.
Daystar Academy,
Daystar Academy.
And that's even not even the most expensive one in Beijing. So Beijing is extremely expensive. It's $30,000 a year to go there.
Most of the kids you have then come from wealthy families, obviously.
They do. And with the supply chain interruptions and what they're saying about what I'm hearing in China, you never know about businesses, who still has their money, who doesn't, because that's the one big thing about the virus is it shut down. China's the number one manufacturing country in the world, and when you shut that down, when you have globalization and you shut down the manufacturing, the people there, you know, you never know who's being hurt financially, who's not being hurt financially. So if this thing drags out, very good possibility it could, because possibility of the reinfections and stuff like that, we don't know. But if it drags out, then a lot of our parents, it might look like a different school. It might look like a different situation, because a lot of the parents will say, I can't afford your school anymore, which leaves them in a big predicament. Because I told you before the show, a lot of times it's true for about 90, 95% of the kids. When they leave a Chinese public school, they can't go back.
Can't go back in.
Can't go back because of the way their tests are, the systems are there, and stuff like that. So when parents pull their kids out of a public school in China, then it's really like an all-in, you know? It's like a baseball game. Once you leave the game, you can't re-enter.
We'll take a break. We'll talk more with Chris Slovic here on It's Your Turn on WISR in just a moment. Miller Shoes, 215 South Main Street, downtown Butler, one of our sponsors on the program today. Well, Mother Nature letting us know that there's still some winter left. We have about a month, you know. And even after spring arrives, you can get some nasty, slushy weather. Need boots or overshoes? They've got them at Miller Shoes. Timberland Shoes and Boots. They've got Go Walk Boots. They've got Rockports. They've got athletic shoes for everybody in the family, men, women, teens, kids. And by the way, if you're looking for athletic shoes, my goodness, they've got all the famous name brands at Miller's. There's no need to go to two or three different stores. They've got Nike and New Balance and Saucony and Rockport and Keds and Skechers and Easy Spirit and Asics and ProPath. They got them all. Miller's Shoes. They are also your local headquarters for SAS Comfort Shoes. Most comfortable shoes you'll ever put on. I feel like bedroom slippers. I really do. And you'll find a great selection in a variety of styles and colors for men and women. SAS Comfort Shoes. Made in America, by the way. Can't say that about too many shoes anymore. Shoes, boots, slippers. Miller's Shoes. For over 125 years. 215 North Main Street in downtown Butler. We will be back to talk more with Chris Slovic on the Friday edition of It's Your Turn, right after these words.
The deals at Tobacco for Less just keep getting better and better. Their stores now include a great loyalty program for valued customers that can help you save on your purchases. Each dollar spent at Tobacco for Less will earn a point. And once you hit 200 points, you can redeem $10 off any purchase of $25 or more. Stock up on their various tobacco products, explore the cigar selection in their walk-in humidor, or check out the great CBD products in their health and wellness department. For all your smoking and vaping needs, visit Tobacco for Less in Butler, Sharon, and Aliquippa.
Welcome back, friends. Hey, if you're just joining us, a lot of folks listen to the radio in the car. Welcome. I'm Dave Malarkey. Chris Slovic is with us. Chris is a graduate of Knock High School, went on to study at Pitt and at Slippery Rock University, and he has become an international educator, teaching in places like Saudi Arabia and most recently in China. In fact, he's still a guidance counselor at Daystar Academy in Beijing. How far away is, I'm sure I'll murder this pronunciation, Wuhan, the epicenter of the coronavirus? How far from Beijing is Wuhan?
So the best way is China's built like a lot like the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So if Beijing is on the same latitude line as Pittsburgh, so I would say if Pittsburgh is Beijing, then Wuhan would be the one on the west coast of Tennessee. I think it's Memphis,
mm-hmm.
the one near
yeah.
Arkansas, because
yeah.
I get them in Nashville screwed up all the time. But it would be like Memphis in Tennessee right now. So I was about a 10-hour drive, 11-hour drive, but you can't say that over there because the way you do things over there is different when you transport and stuff. So there's no, let's get in a car and just, well, you can get in a car and drive, but it's a lot harder to do than here.
Let's talk a little bit about life in China, if you don't mind. I think our listeners would be interested.
Absolutely.
For example, I know they have a lot more cars than they did 25 years ago.
Yeah, they did.
What about highways? Do they have anything comparable to an interstate, or does it tend to be smaller two-lane roads, or what?
Well, I would say a couple things. I love this driving because this is going to be great. This might be the highlight of the program right here. I'll start off by saying going to work and on Facebook one day I posted somebody driving on the sidewalk and beeping at people to get out of the way.
Wow.
30 years ago, there wasn't a car culture, you know, and everybody that has been there for a long time has said the biggest thing has been the cars. Because Beijing, what, 30 years ago was 12, 13 million people, and now it's 26. And now all those people have cars, and there's a lot of Chinese brand cars, and there's a lot of that. But the infrastructure, they're building out in China. China's a very weird-shaped city because in the middle of it, you'd expect all these big buildings and stuff. But in the middle of it's like Line 1, which is forbidden. So Line 1, I talk subway talk, look at that, which is forbidden city. It's a lot of temples and all that in the middle. And then it's like spread out. It's like a donut.
Oh.
And it's all laid out. But all those earlier ones, I mean, Beijing has been around for thousands of years. Obviously not as big. But when they expand it out, they have three-lane highways going each way, so that's six lanes. But when I go, there's from Beijing, there's a place called Sanlitun, okay? Sanlitun is where all the Westerners go, Western restaurants, great home plate, all ribs, everything. Oh, it's great. It's my savior. But that's, I would say, 20 kilometers, which would be, let's see, 0.6. That's about 13 miles. So 13 miles. It takes me about an hour to get there a taxi.
Wow.
And the taxis are cheap. Thank goodness. They're very cheap. Like I can spend an hour in a taxi and only spend $11, you know, for an hour in a taxi. In New York City, that'd be like $60, you know. So, and when you go in there, imagine, I know a lot of people have 28 construction. You know when they have construction on Route 28?
Yeah,
I haven't been back in like, I haven't been like, living here consecutively for like 6 years, but I know the way they do construction on Route 28, there's probably construction on Route 28. I'm just guessing that, but I'm probably right. Imagine being stuck in that, you know, the construction traffic where you merge and you do all that stuff, but that's everyday driving, and that lasts for 12 or 13 miles.
Uh-huh.
And that's why Saudi Arabia, I had a car. And at the time when I was there, it led the world in fatalities per person for driving accidents. But I still had a car there. It's the type of driving, that closed kind of merging in and out and not knowing the patterns. There's certainly a pattern. It's a free-for-all, which has its patterns in it. But it's tough to pick up. I don't think I could drive in that situation.
Well, is there a subway system in Beijing?
There is. The subway system is actually quite good at some points and quite packed in some other points. They have subways that come like every 2 minutes. They have subway points and they're developing it. And they're actually, it's really widespread because Bangkok's a city of 10 million people, and their above trains and their subway system isn't as developed as somebody. I mean, there's 16 different lines, and basically you could go anywhere you want in the city. It'll take you a little bit. Actually, it won't take you longer, same amount of time. But for the equivalent of, let's see, the RMB is 7 to 1 to the dollar. So I'm doing some conversion. See, a practical use for algebra, finally.
That's the basic denomination of Chinese currency?
7 to 1, yeah. So it's but 7 RMB.
What did you RMB. Call it? RAB?
It's RMB. It's called the Yuan, Y-U-A-N, but it has nicknames like the RMB. It's the Renminbi, but it's called a couple different things. They call it Kwai for slang, like 3 Kwai, 4 Kwai. It's slang, like we call dollars bucks. And stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's the equivalent. I could go across the city, and the city's huge, but I could go across the city for like 60 cents, 70 cents each way. So it's like $2 across the city.
Practically nothing.
Yeah. And that's pretty nice.
What about, you said that Beijing is on almost the same latitude as Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Is the climate similar because you'd be about the same distance from the equator?
Sure. It's like Kansas City because Beijing is a lot drier. It's almost a desert. People don't realize it. It's almost. It's very arid. It's like the Midwest.
Huh.
where last year, it's weird, it rained more this year, but last year we got, except for July and August, we got 4 days of rain, 5 days, where, and it doesn't rain like here. Here, you can get a whole day wiped out with rain. There, it's very rare that you get a day wiped out with rain. So I would say the everyday temperature, it's very, very consistent. Very consistent. If you look at here, it spikes. You get like 28 degrees here. But next Wednesday, I read it's going to be like 60 degrees. Sorry to steal your weather report back there. But it's like you spikes. You don't get that. You don't get that as often in Beijing. It's like they use Celsius over there. So you'll see like 3, 3, 2, 2, 4, 3, 3, like that.
What about the topography? Are there mountains and hills, or does it look like, you know, Indiana, flat as a pancake?
It's like Beijing is in a valley. So it looks like a baseball diamond, really, like Fenway Park. If anybody's been to Anchorage, it looks a lot like Anchorage, but way bigger. So the reason why the pollution gets in there, it's settled in a valley. And then where the Great Wall is are mountains. So think of like you're standing on home plate, but home plate's on south. Okay, past second base and in the outfield, you get that mountains that would be like an outfield wall. And the wall is on that.
The Great Wall of China.
The Great Wall. Yeah. And there's different sections to the Great Wall. There's restored, unrestored, and stuff like that. So it's very interesting. But it's whenever they call bad pollution days, whenever they happen, the weather and all that stuff, just it just sits in the valley and it doesn't move.
I've read about that. In fact, it was a problem when the Olympics were held in Beijing a few years ago for the Olympic athletes. Hey, folks, you've seen the film Bridge on the River Kwai, have you not? Guess what? Chris was there. We'll talk about that when we come back from this break on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be right back.
When planning a funeral, should cremation be considered? That subject comes up a lot these days, and Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler can help to answer your many questions about cremation. Is it appropriate for your family? Should there be an actual funeral service, keeping in mind that it's a time to celebrate the meaningful life of your loved one? And of course, we look at the bottom line. What's the cost? Thompson Miller's cremation program offers three advantages: simplicity, convenience, and it's all performed locally here in Butler. We assure you that your loved one will never leave our care at any point in the process. Let's talk it over privately right here at Thompson Miller. We've been serving the Butler community for more than 90 years. A third generation of the same family is here for you. Call us at 724-287-3706, 287-3706. Or online at www.thompson-miller.com. Thompson Miller, at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, because we care.
Bridge on the River Kwai is one of my favorite movies. I've probably seen it 15 times, maybe more, I'm not sure. When you were in Thailand recently, you went there? You crossed the River Kwai, Chris?
Yes, I did. it's funny because the bridge that they built is they took it down after the war. So they have another bridge that's over. But they have tours, and it's funny because when I was over there, I took a tour package. And over there, tours are cheap. Like, when we're talking cheap, the whole thing, all day. So a two-hour ride from Bangkok to Kanchanaberry. I know I'm butchering the name of the thing, but
hey,
it's on the hat.
No, nobody here knows.
Yeah, that's okay. I'll just keep saying the same thing.
Just say the River Kwai.
Yeah, River Kwai. So let's see. Out there, plus a train ride. But the train ride over there, it's the hot part of the season. So April's the hottest month of the year. So we were in a train on the tour for about an hour and a half, no air conditioning. It was like being in a sauna, 95 degrees, no air conditioning. It's like, and people selling water. Man, I took like three of them. But anyway, so we went over. It's really nice. They have war museums there. And I really encourage people once in their life to visit a war museum because it's a different kind of feeling you get when you go in there. And I know we have some with Civil War here and Gettysburg and stuff like that. I know it's – but – when you go even see other countries, it's like you see the scale of things. And for me, you know, you get reminded sometimes of what can happen and that can happen anywhere. And you get that feeling when you go to a war cemetery, it's just a different kind of feeling because you see all the hopes and dreams in the ground. And that really makes you think about, put perspective on life.
I don't remember where they actually filmed Bridge on the River Kwai, whether it was in some other place in Asia or whether it was actually on the River Kwai. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
I'm not sure either. I wish I could answer that for you.
Does the River Kwai look like in the movie?
The River Kwai is built up today. It's built up in that one area where the bridge is, the newer bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can walk across the train tracks, and they still use the train tracks, so it's very interesting when a train comes across. So
check down below from dynamite down there.
Yeah. So it's built up there, but when you take – there's another bridge right close to it called the Death Bridge. And the Death Bridge is where another bridge, which still is active today, it's about a kilometer long, which is 6/10 of a mile. And it goes over, and they finish that in 7 days.
Wow.
7 days, and it still goes today. And, you know, I know some people with their basements or roofs after 5 years, you're like, what in the world? But it's that feeling, too, like when you go over it and you actually experience, you can see pictures. But when you're on a train going over, going, people, like 20, 30,000 people died making this. And you're going over it going, this was done in 7 days? And it's like, wow. It's just a feeling. It's one of the things when you go that I encourage anybody to go to because it really puts perspective on things.
Hmm. When you're in China teaching, do you have an opportunity to travel at all and see the country, or do you have any desire to do that, or are you allowed to do that?
Yes, you can. You can. You can. It's there are three major holidays in our school. There's Golden Week, which is in October, which we use as our fall break.
Mm-hmm.
But that celebrates the country's independence. They just had their 70th year of being current China as they are. And then what they do is they go all the way to this last Chinese New Year. That's the next holiday. That's the 2 weeks. And then we have a spring break. So we can travel. If anybody's going there, I would say avoid the Chinese holidays because that's when everybody's off.
Yeah.
As Westerners, we're told if you're thinking about teaching in China or nobody in China knows somebody, then you take the American break off, which is a spring break, and you do all your visiting in the country because everybody else is working and there are no lines or anything like that to get in. And when there are lines. Like there are lines like Hall of Fame lines. Like lines I never even conceived in my life would even exist. But yeah, so you can travel throughout the country. Now, for the most part, the country, I'm not sure about as you get closer to the borders of Afghanistan and Kazakhstan and stuff like that.
Or the Soviet Union, for that matter. There's a significant boundary with the Soviet Union.
It's a little bit less, though.
It's not the Soviet Union anymore.
But a little bit less because they got Mongolia. Mongolia is kind of like their border. And I know a couple of Mongolians I talked to, they feel like they're in a rock and a hard place because they're kind of a buffer. If you look at the shape of China, Mongolia is most of that northern border.
It is, yeah.
And I'm
not sure.
You have
to get way over toward the Pacific coast before there's a border with Russia.
I'm not sure. They border a lot of countries. The border with Russia, I think, is very shallow.
Mm-hmm.
But where it is, it's not. China and Russia do have their differences, but it's not as tumultuous, I think, as the Western part is and whatever's going on there, you know.
I have to squeeze one final break in here and we'll wrap up our very, very interesting conversation with Chris Slovic here on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be back right after these words. Time for a checkup for your pet. We recommend Suburban Animal Clinic. Or maybe Fido or Tabby's not feeling so well. Suburban Animal Clinic, a small animal veterinary practice located Route 8 south of Butler at the intersection with Thorncrest Drive. It's about 5 miles south of Butler. Suburban Animal Clinic, in the spirit of Dr. Dennis Damon. Their services include wellness checks for your pet, of course, also emergency care. They have laser therapy, dental available, also prescription diets. You know, one of the things that are problems for a lot of our pets these days, being overweight. Microchipping, they can handle that as well. Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, south of Butler. If you're headed south from Butler toward Pittsburgh, as soon as you pass all the auto dealerships, start looking on your left. That's Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8 South at Thorncrest Drive. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Chris Slovic has been spending some time with us here. Chris is a graduate of Knock High School. He has been teaching internationally for 6 years now?
This is Arizona 2 years, and this will be my fourth year overseas. Okay. So a total of six.
Taught in Saudi Arabia and most recently in China. He's still teaching there, but via the internet nowadays, because he was able to get out of the Orient just as the coronavirus epidemic was starting to explode, and he's not quite sure when he's going to be able to go back. What do you do at the end of a school day in Beijing? Can you, I mean, you can't really turn on the TV and watch TV unless, I don't know, maybe they got the BBC on the cable over there in Beijing, huh?
They kind of do. They have their local programming, but a lot of people do internet TV. A lot of expats. We use something called a VPN, which is a virtual private network or something like that. And what that does is that gets you around all the government censorship. So I can go on Facebook, but I got to go on a VPN. So for me, the TV, you're right. I can't understand, you know, the TV. There's no – I don't believe there's – too much of an English division of CCTV. Mm-hmm. They have different languages and stuff like that. But the local programming, you're right. International programming, it's funny because in Saudi you can just turn on a satellite TV because it was free to everybody. And you're just, oh, there's a BBC, here's this, here's that. In China, it's more, for what I do, it's more internet-based.
Can you get... can you read any newspaper that you want online, or do they... do they block some of them out?
A VPN. So here's the thing about the VPN. You might say, well, if you get a VPN, what's the point of having a firewall? A VPN's cost a lot of money. And you need to be outside a VPN country to get on a website to get the VPN to go back in. So in the United States, I need to get my VPN here. Mm-hmm. And then I go over and put a code in, no big deal. But there are times... and I'm just going to say this very, very nicely. There are times which are very sensitive over there in which the government blocks all VPNs. And my concern, and I think it's a legitimate one, is communication during this virus. Because if things get really dicey, which I'm not doubting that they are now or not or whatever... but my question as an expat, which they call people who live in a country that's not their passport, they call us expats, is will I be able to communicate home? Will I be able to communicate with people? Will I be able to communicate? Yeah. Because if I have no VPN, then I have way less options.
You have been blessed to be able to travel so far. And you mentioned during one of our breaks, Chris, that you'd like to leave a message to young people today that anybody can do this. You don't have to be of special privilege or rank if you have a desire to teach internationally like you do.
Yeah.
Follow your dream.
Yeah, I think it's I feel very fortunate in what I'm doing. But I want to stress that I think it's less of a blessing because it kind of makes it seem like you have to have some preconditions to do what I'm doing, and you don't. All you have to do is you have to have a will and a desire, And those are kind of extreme because you're going to be in places where if your family gets sick, you can't hop on a plane and see them. Mm-hmm. You can't come home for 3 or 4 days. You will experience cultures and different things, but sometimes to the extremes. Like right now, there's a virus, or you might go to a place where there's a civil war. You might go to a place where war breaks out. A couple buddies of mine, the Noviks, who rhyme with Slovak, but Noviks, they were in Syria at a school when the civil war broke out.
Oh.
And my old principal was in Bangladesh in Dhaka, very good school in Dhaka, very good school, but he was in a park and a bomb went off. So there are trade-offs, but anybody can do it. And my thought process on doing this was, if I'm going to do something, get domestic experience, that's fine. But if I'm going to get experience, why not travel? Because it's in my bug. It's a fit for me. It might not be for everybody, but if it's a fit for you, anybody can do it. And why would I not just take this time and go and do it? Because once I come back to PA, I'm stuck. I'm here forever. And I would also say, last thing is, if you have kids or something, your new teachers, if new teachers are listening to this and they say, well, we got a couple kids, if you have enough experience or whatever and you go to a really good school, like in Yanbu, they had child care all day and you lived on an extremely family-friendly compound, but you get your education, most places around the world, up to 2 kids for free in a school that might cost 20 grand a year to go to, you're going to have the best chance for your kids to get into a great school, a great college, a great education, great experience. But yeah, they can't see grandma and grandpa, you know, every weekend. You can't see. That's the trade-off. So if it's a fit, I'd say do it. It doesn't matter where you come from. Doesn't matter how much money you have now. It doesn't, you know, if it's a fit, then I would say go ahead and do it.
Thanks for chatting with us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Just a fascinating conversation. Yeah. A great human interest story. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks. Folks, enjoy the rest of your day and the weekend. I hope you can be with us on Monday for It's Your Turn, starting at 12:30.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you.